Alston, always a little behind, thought she just wanted to shut him up and spare him embarrassment.
"I'll get suited up," the security chief said.
Lane just watched him, saying nothing.
"What?" Alston stared. "Wait, no!"
Cast essentially ignored him, eyes fixed on the ancient engineer.
"You're sure?"
Lane herself seemed anything but. Cast shrugged brutally.
"I'm doing fuck all good up here. We need to go clear those vermin off the hull."
There was precious little enthusiasm in his voice. Perhaps he was waiting for Lane to give some convincing reason that he should stay. Her creased face was twisted in indecision, though. An engineer seeking a solution to a technical problem she could not overcome. At that point, Holston's console flickered into activity again, and he realized the attackers on the outside had located the clear channels that Cast had been using to control his drones, and that Cast would soon be using to communicate with the ship. It was Holston's job to notify everyone the moment the spiders made this discovery, but he said nothing, part of him staring at the sudden patchy scatter of signals being picked up by the Gilgamesh's surviving receivers, the rest of him listening to the conversation going on behind him.
"Your team?"
Lane prompted at last.
"My core team are suited and ready," Cast confirmed. "It looks like we might have a fight the moment we open the airlock. Little bastards could be out there already, cutting in."
Nobody was arguing with him, but he went on.
"I can't ask them to go and me stay behind."
And then,
"This is what I'm for, isn't it? I'm not a strategist. I'm not a commander. I lead people. My team."
He stood before Lane like a general who had disappointed his queen, and now felt that he had only one way to redeem himself.
"Let's face it. Security was only ever here to keep key crew and cargo in place for the duration of the trip. But if we have to be soldiers, then we'll be soldiers. And I'll lead."
"Cast," Lane started, and then dried up. Holston wondered whether she had been about to say something bizarrely trite, some piece of social ornament like, "If you don't want to go, then don't." But they were long past what people did or didn't want to do. Nobody had wanted the situation they found themselves in now, and their language, like their technology, had been pared down to only those things essential to life. Nothing else, none of the fripperies and flourishes, had been cost-effective to maintain.
"I'll get suited up," the security chief repeated tiredly, with a nod.
He paused as though he wanted to throw out some more military form of acknowledgement, a salute from those about to die, and then he turned and left. Lane watched him go, leaning on her metal stick, and there was a similar ramrod stiffness to her bearing, despite her crooked spine. Her bony knuckles were white, and everyone in that room was watching her. She took two deliberate steps until she was at Holston's shoulder, then glowered about her at the handful of tribe engineers still left in comms.
"Get to work," she snapped at them. "There's always something that needs fixing."
Having dispersed their attention, she took a deep breath, then let it out, close enough to Holston's ear that he heard the faint wheezing of her lungs.
"He was right, wasn't he?" she said very softly, for his ears only. "We need to clear them from the hull, and the security detail will fight better if Cast's out there with them."
It was not that she had told the man to go, but a word from her might have stopped him. Holston glanced up at her and tried to make himself nod, but something went wrong with the motion, and the result was meaningless and non-committal.
"What's this?"
Lane demanded abruptly, noticing the stream of signals on his screen.
"They found our gap. They're transmitting." "Then why the fuck didn't you say?"
she called out.
"Cast!"
Then waited until Alpash confirmed that she was connected to the man.
"We're changing frequencies, so get your people ready."
Next, giving him the new clear channel. "Holston?"
"Vetus is wrong," he told her. "They're not biological machines. They're not just Curran's puppets."
"And how are you supposed to have worked that one out?"
"Because of how they communicate."
She frowned.
"You've cracked that now, and didn't think to tell anyone?"
"No, not what they're saying, but the structure.
Issa, I'm a classicist,
and a lot of that is a study of language. Old languages, dead languages, languages from an age of humanity that doesn't exist anymore.
I'd stake my life that these signals are actually language, rather than just some sort of instructions. It's too complex, too intricately structured. It's inefficient, Issa. Language is inefficient. It evolves organically. This is language. Real language.
Lane squinted down at the screen for a few seconds until the transmissions abruptly cut off as the jamming switched frequencies.
What difference does it make? She asked quietly. Does it get Vetus's fucking prisoners out of their cells?
It doesn't, Holston.
But tell me how it helps us, she invited. Tell me how any of this speculation does us any good. Or is it just like all the rest of your bag of tricks? Academic in every sense of the word.
We're ready,
came Karst's voice at that moment, as though he had been politely waiting for her to finish.
We're in the airlock. We're about to open the hatch.
Lane's face was like a death mask. She had never been intended as a commander, either. Holston could see every one of those centuries of hard decisions in the lines on her face.
Go, she confirmed. And good luck.
Karst had a squad of 22 ready to go, and that used up all the heavy EVA suits that were still functioning. Another 12 were currently being worked on, and he was only grateful that the tribe had needed to go out and make patch repairs on the hull, or he might not even be able to field that many soldiers. Soldiers. He thought of them as soldiers. Some of them actually were soldiers, military woken up from cargo either this time or the last time. Added piecemeal to the security detail whenever he had needed a bit more muscle. Others were veterans of his team, key crew who had been with him from the start. He was taking only the best, which in this case meant almost everyone who had the appropriate EVA training. He remembered very clearly when he himself had gone through that training. It had seemed a complete waste of time, but he had wanted to win a place in key crew on the Gilgamesh, and it had been something they had been looking for. He had spent months bumbling about in orbit, learning how to move in zero gravity, how to step with magnetic boots, acclimatizing to the nausea and the disorientation of such a hostile and inimical environment. Nobody had mentioned fighting an army of spiders for the survival of the human race, but Karst half fancied he might have imagined it, daydreamed it back when he was young and the Gilgamesh project was still just an idea. Surely he had seen himself standing on the hull of a mighty, embattled colony ship, weapon to hand, beating away the alien horde. Now, in the airlock, his breath loud in his ears, and the suit's confines pressing and leaden, it didn't seem at all as much fun as he had imagined. The hatch they were about to exit through was set in the floor from where he was standing. There would be a vertiginous shift of perspective as they got out, carabinered to one another, and trying not to be flung off the ship's side by the rotating section's centripetal force. Then they would have to trust to their boots to hold them, progressing along a surface that would constantly try to dislodge them. Things would have been easier, perversely, had they been accelerating or decelerating in deep space, with the inner sense of down falling towards the front or the rear of the ship, and the rotating sections stilled. But they were in orbit now, free-falling around the planet, and therefore forced to fake their own gravity.
Chief,
one of his team warned.
We're losing air.
Of course we're.
Then he stopped, because he hadn't given the order to open the external doors. They had been standing here on the brink for some time, and the words had been reluctant to emerge. Now someone, something, was forcing his hand. Somewhere on the hatch there must be a pinhole letting out their air. The spiders were out there, right now, trying to claw their way in.
"Everyone latch down and lock your boots,"
he ordered, and now he was faced with action. The thoughts were coming smoothly and without undue emotional embroidery.
"You better crouch low. I want the outer door open quick as you like, without the air venting first."
One of the tribe confirmed his instructions in his ear, and Karst followed his own advice. Instead of the steady grinding of the hatch that he expected, someone had obviously taken that quick as you like to heart and activated some sort of emergency override, snapping the hatch open within seconds so that the pressurized air around them thundered through the resulting breach like a hammer. Karst felt it raking at him, trying to drag him out with it to enjoy the vast open vistas of the universe. But his lines and boots held, and he weathered the storm.
One of his team was immediately torn loose beside him, yanked halfway through the opening, and only saved by her anchoring line. Cast reached out and grabbed her glove, clumsily pulling her back until she was against the subjective floor beside the gaping hole. He saw some fragments then, jointed legs and a torn open something that must have been most of a body caught by the mechanism of the hatch. Beyond were the enemy. They were in disarray, crawling over one another. Several had been battered away by the decompression, and he hoped that a few had been lost to space. But there were at least three or four dangling out at the end of threads, and beginning to climb back up towards the hatch. Cast aimed his gun. It was built into his glove, and was a refreshingly simple piece of kit, overall. Nothing in the airless wastes of vacuum would stop a chemical propellant working if it contained its own oxygen, and the airless void should be a perfect marksman's paradise, his range limited only by the curve of the Gilgamesh's hull. He wanted to say something inspiring or dramatic, but in the end, the sight of the creeping, leg-waving, spasmodically scuttling monsters so horrified him that
"Kill the fuckers!"
was all he could manage. He shot but missed three times, trying to adjust for the surreal perspective, and mistaking the distance and size of his quarry, his suit's targeting system mulish about locking on to the little vermin. Then he caught it, sending one of the beasts that still remained on the hull spinning away. His team was shooting as well, careful and controlled, and the spiders were plainly utterly unprepared for what was happening. Cast saw their angular, leggy bodies being hurled away on all sides, the dead ones dangling straight out from the hull like macabre balloons. Some of them were returning fire, which gave him a nasty turn. They had some sort of weapons, though the projectiles were slow and bulky compared to the sleek zip of bullets from the human-made guns. For a moment, Cast thought that they were throwing stones again, but the missiles were something like ice or glass. They shattered against the armoured suits, causing no damage. The spiders were unexpectedly resilient, clad in some sort of close-woven armour that had them dancing about under the impact of the bullets, without necessarily letting any penetrate, and Cast and his fellows had to hose several of them with shot before something got through. They exploded quite satisfactorily, though, once they died. Soon, if there were any enemy survivors, they had fled. Cast paused a moment, reporting back to Lane before taking the big step of putting himself outside on the hull, out before the curtailed horizon of the Gilgamesh. Then there was nothing for it, so he went. The heavy EVA suits were proper military technology, although most of the actual military systems Cast would have liked to have accessed were not online or had been removed entirely. After all, the engineers had not needed sophisticated targeting programs when going out to make repairs. Like everything else that survived of the human race, a tyranny of priorities had come into force. Still, the suits were reinforced at the joints and armoured everywhere else, with servos to help the determined space warrior actually move about in them. They had an extended air supply, recycled waste, controlled temperature, and if the hull sensors had actually been left intact, then Cast would have had a lovely little map of everything around him. As it was, he climbed laboriously through the hatch in a second skin that bulked out his torso and each limb to twice its actual circumference, feeling hot and cramped, sensing the slight shudder as ancient and lovingly maintained servo motors considered each second whether or not they would relinquish the ghost and seize up. Some of the suits still had functioning jetpacks to allow for limited manoeuvring while away from the hull, but fuel was at a premium, and Cast had given the order to save it for emergencies. He was unconvinced that using the antiquated, oft-repaired flight packs was not just one step too far towards a death trap. His image of his surroundings was the cluttered and narrow view from his faceplate and a handful of feeds from cameras on his squadmates' suits, which he was having difficulty matching up to the actual individuals concerned.
"Lane, can you send everyone instructions on a formation and their place in it?"
It felt like admitting defeat, but he did not have the tools that the suit's inventor had anticipated to hand.
"I need eyes looking out every way. We're heading for Shuttle Bay 7 doors. Close this airlock behind us, and the outer door's compromised somewhere."
"It's not closing," came Alpash's voice.
"Something's gone wrong."
Well, and then Cast realized he had nothing much to say to that. He could hardly demand they came out and fixed it right now.
Well, seal the inner door until we return. We're going now.
Then Lane's instructions came through, showing them her best guess at a route to take and a formation for the security team to fall into, eyes focused all around.
We've got another drone launching, she added. I'll send it far out to look down on you and patch it into your...
Fuck.
What? Cast demanded immediately. No drone. Just get to the shuttle bay. Double time.
Huh, you try fucking double time in these things. But Cast was moving, the point of the arrow, and his team shambled into place, step after hulking metal step along the hull.
And let me guess, drone bay off to the shuttle, right?
Well done. The drone had simply not got out of the bay, hanging tangled in webbing that its sensors could not even detect, its launch hatch still open. Holston had no idea what sort of access the drone bays gave to the rest of the ship, but Lane was already sending people that way, so presumably that meant the creatures were aboard. They had camera feeds from Cast and a handful of his people, though by no means all, recording their slogging progress outside on the hull, constantly surveying the ground before them over that truncated horizon.
Blind, hissed Lane furiously.
The network of hull sensors was in pieces, hundreds of maintenance hours of damage inflicted in just minutes.
Where are they, then? Where else?
Holston opened his mouth, another chance for a trite and meaningless remark, and then alarms began to go off.
Hull breach in cargo,
Alpash said flatly, and then, with a curious deadness to his tone, that's the second breach, of course, after the impact earlier.
There's already a hole in cargo,
Lane echoed the sentiment, eyes seeking out Holston's.
They're probably already inside.
Then why make another hole?
Cargo's big, Alpash said. They must be boring in all over the ship. They don't need hatches. We...
His eyes were wide as he looked at Lane beseechingly.
What are we going to do?
Cargo. Holston thought of those thousands of sleepers, oblivious in their little plastic coffins. He thought of spiders descending upon them, coasting in the gravity-free vacuum towards their prey. He thought of eggs. Perhaps Lane harboured similar thoughts.
Cast! She snapped. Cast, we need your people inside. We're coming up on the shuttle bay hatch now,
Cast reported, as though he hadn't heard.
Cast, they're inside, Lane insisted.
There was a pause, though the clomping progress of the cameras didn't slow.
Get people there from the inside. I'll deal with this, then we'll head back in. Or do you want them actually right outside your door? Cast, cargo is without gravity and atmosphere. I can't just send...
Lane started.
Let me kill this nest, and then we'll be back,
Cast spoke over her.
We'll keep a lid on it, don't worry.
He sounded maddeningly calm. Then another transmission came in from aboard the ship. A moment of garbled shouting and screaming, then nothing. Silence followed. Lane and Alpash and Holston stared at one another, appalled.
Who was that?
The ancient engineer asked at last.
Alpash, what did we... I don't know. I'm trying. Call in, please. Call in. All...
There was a flurry of brief acknowledgements from different groups of the tribe and reawakened military across the ship, and Holston could see Alpash checking them off. Even before they had finished, someone was shouting.
They're here! Get out! Get out! They're inside!
Confirm your position. Alpash's voice was strained.
Lorry, confirm your position.
Alpash, Lane started.
That's my family, the young engineer said.
He was away from his station suddenly.
That's our living quarters. They're all in there. My kin. Our children.
Alpash, stay at your post, Lane ordered him, hand trembling on her stick. But her authority, the leverage of her age and pedigree, was right now just smoke. Alpash had the hatch open and was gone.
There they are,
came Cast's triumphant shout over the comms. And then,
where are the rest of them?
Lane's mouth opened, her eyes dragged irresistibly towards the screens. There was a handful of spiders about the shuttle bay hatch, caught in the glare of the sun, long angular shadows cast down the length of the hull. Less, though, than there had been. And perhaps that just meant that the others had gone for easier access points. The chaos over the comms showed that the creatures were establishing beachheads all over the ship. "Cast," from Lane, surely too quietly for him to respond. Holston saw one of the spiders abruptly shatter, torn open by a shot from Cast or one of his team. Then someone shouted, "Behind us!" And the camera views were swinging around, giving wheeling views of the hull and the stars. "I'm caught!" came from someone, and others of the security team were no longer moving. Holston saw one man, pinned in the camera view of a comrade, fighting something unseen, slapping and pulling at his suit, the drifting net of threads that had ensnared him invisible, yet too strong to break. The spiders were emerging then, racing along the curve of the hull with a speed that laughed at Cast's plodding progress. Others were steering down from above, where they had been drifting at the end of more thread, climbing up against the outwards force of the rotating section, climbing to where they could leap on Cast and his men. Cast's upraised gun glove, at the corner of his camera, flashed and flared, trying to track the new targets, killing at least one. They saw one of Cast's people being hit by friendly fire, boots torn off the hull by the impact, falling away from the ship to end up jerking on the end of an unseen line as an eight-legged monster came inching up towards his helpless, flailing form. Men and women were shouting, shooting, screaming, trying to run away at their leaden, crippled pace. Cast stumbled back two heavy paces, still shooting, seeing his helmet display record the remaining rounds in his helical magazine. More by luck than judgment, he picked one of the creatures off as it alighted on the woman next to him, spraying freezing pieces of carapace and viscera that rattled as they bounced off him. She was caught in the webbing the little bastards had seeded the hull with, just great loose clouds of the fine stuff that had half his people now completely ensnared. His ears were full of people shouting, his team, others from inside the ship, even Lane. He tried to remember how to shut down the channels. It was all too loud. He couldn't think. The thunder of his own hoarse breathing roared over it, like a hyperventilating giant bellowing at each ear. He saw another of his people fly loose from the hull, cancelling the grip of his boots without anything else to secure him. He just flew away, ascending into the infinite. If his suit had thrusters, they weren't working now. The luckless man just kept going, receding into the infinite, as though he just could not abide to share the ship with the busy monsters intent on getting inside it. Another spider landed on the trapped woman beside Cast, just sailing in at the end of a colossal leap, its legs outstretched. He could hear her screaming, and he stumbled forwards, trying to aim at the thing as the woman flailed and bludgeoned at it with her gloved hands. It was clinging to her, and Cast saw it carefully line up its mouthparts, or some mechanism attached to them, and then hunch forwards, lancing her between the plates of her suit with sudden, irresistible force. The suit would seal around a puncture, of course, but that would not help against whatever she had been injected with. Cast tried to call up medical information from her suit, but he could not remember how. She had gone still, just swaying limply against the anchor point of her magnetic boots. Whatever it was quick-acting. He finally managed to turn off all the voices in his head, leaving only his own. There was a moment of blessed calm, in which it seemed possible, somehow, that he could regain control of the situation. There would be some magic word, some infinitely efficacious command that a truly gifted leader could give, one that would restore the rightful arrow of evolution and allow humanity to triumph over these aberrations. Something landed on his back. Chapter 7.8 The War Inside. Like an ant colony, is Portia's thought. It is not true, though, just something she tells herself to counter the vastly alien surroundings that weigh upon her. She comes from a city that is a forest, filled with complex many-sided spaces,
and yet the architects of her people have cut even that three-dimensional geography down to their own size, compartmentalizing the vast until it is manageable, controllable. Here the giants have done the same, making chambers that for them are perhaps a little cramped and constricting, but to Portia, the exaggerated scale of it all is frightening, a constant reminder of the sheer size and physical power of the godlike beings that created this place, and whose descendants dwell here still. Worse is the relentless geometry of it. Portia is used to a city of 1,000 angles, a chain of walls and floors and ceilings strung at every possible slant, a world of taut silk that can be taken down and put back up, divided and subdivided, and endlessly tailored to suit. The giants must live their lives amongst these rigid, unvarying right angles, entombed between these massive, solid walls. Nothing makes any attempt to mimic nature. Instead, everything is held in the iron hand of that dominating, alien aesthetic. Her peer group is through the savage Shuttle Bay doors, the breach sealed up behind them to minimize pressure loss. She has just had a brief window of radio contact with other groups, a hurried catch-up before the giants change their own frequency and obliterate all the others with their invisible storm. There are 6 separate peer groups within the great ship now, several of them in a section that had no air of its own. Attempts to coordinate are hopeless. Every troop is on its own. They encounter the first defenders shortly afterwards, perhaps 20 giants arriving with violent intent before the spiders can set up their large-scale weapons. The vibrations of the enemy's approach serves as forewarning of an almost absurd degree, and Portia's band, a dozen of them now, are able to set an ambush. A hastily woven spring trap catches the front-running giants in a mess of poorly constructed webbing, not enough to hold them for long, but enough to drag them to a stop where their fellows will crash into them. They have weapons, not just the lethally swift projectiles of their compatriots outside, but also a kind of focused vibration that runs like mad screaming through every fibre of Portia's body, shocking all the spiders into motionlessness and killing one outright. Then the spiders begin shooting back. The weapons slung beneath their bodies are far slower than bullets, closer to the ancient slingshots Portia's ancestors used. Their ammunition is 3-pronged glass darts, formed to spin in flight. Here, in gravity, their range is relatively short, but the interior of the Gilgamesh does not allow for much long-distance marksmanship anyway. Portia and her peers are, at the very least, extremely good shots, excellent judges of distance and relative motion. Some of the giants wear armour like those outside. Most do not. When the darts draw blood, they snap, tips shearing off and their contents being forced into the curiously elaborate circulatory systems the giants boast, to be hurried about their bodies by their own racing metabolisms. Only a tiny amount is needed for full effect, and the carefully measured concoction works very swiftly, going straight for the brain. Portia watches the giants drop, spasming and going rigid, one by one. The few armoured enemy are dealt with by the more risky approach of direct injection. Portia loses 4 of her squad, and knows that if the ambush had failed, they might all have died. Still, their numbers within the ship are growing steadily. Whilst she would rather survive, she has always accepted the reasonable chance that this mission would mean her death. Her field chemist is still alive and ready for orders. Portia does not stint. The messenger said there will be vents to allow circulation of air about the vessel. The precise logistics of keeping the living quarters of an ark ship supplied with breathable air are somewhat beyond Portia's understanding, but Avrana Kern's information has been understood to the degree required. Their hairy bodies sensitive to movement even through their vacuum coating, the spiders quickly track down the faint motion of air from the vents. Out there, Portia knows, there will be armies of giants mustering, no doubt expecting the spiders to come against them. But that is not the plan. The field chemist sets up her weapon swiftly, preparing the elegantly crafted mixture to discharge into the air ducts, where it will find its way around the ship. "Move on," Portia orders when she is done. They have plenty more such chemical weapons to put in place.
There are a large number of giants on the ship, after all. When they understood at last what Evrana Kern had been trying to communicate with them, when it became obvious that the path their species travelled would bring them inevitably into collision with a civilization of giant creator gods, the spiders turned to the past for inspiration, seeking out learning buried since the early days of their history. But for them, history could be remembered like yesterday. They had never suffered the problem with human records, that so much is lost forever as the grinding wheel of the years groans on. Their distant ancestors, in conjunction with the nanovirus, evolved the ability to pass on learning and experience genetically, direct to their offspring, a vital stepping stone in a species with next to no parental care. So it is that knowledge of far distant times is preserved in great detail, initially passed from parents to their brood, and later distilled and available for any spider to incorporate into mind and genes. Globally, the spiders have assembled a vast library of experience to draw upon, a facility that has contributed to their swift rise from obscurity to orbit. Hidden in this arachnid Alexandria are remarkable secrets. For example, generations ago, during the Great War with the Ants, there were giants that walked briefly upon the Green World, crew from the selfsame Ark ship that Portia has now invaded. One of those giants was captured and held for many long years. The understandings of the time did not include the belief that it was sentient, and scientists now twitch and skitter in frustration at what might have been learned had their forebears only tried a little harder to communicate. However, that is not to say that nothing was learned at all from the captive giant. During its lifetime, and especially after its eventual death, the scholars of the time did their best to examine the creature's biochemistry and metabolism, comparing it to the small mammals they shared their world with. In their library of first-hand knowledge, the spiders uncovered a great deal of how human biochemistry works. Armed with that knowledge, and a supply of mice and similar animals as test subjects, not ideal, but the best they had, the spiders developed their great last-ditch weapon against the invaders. There was much argument between the chosen representatives of cities and great peer groups, and between them all and Evrana Kern as well. Other solutions and possibilities were pared away, until the spider's nature and the extremity of the situation left only this one. Even now, Portia and the other assault squads are the first to find out that their solution works, at least for now. The Gilgamesh's sensors barely register the concoction as it passes into the ship's circulation, creeping about the rotating crew section one chamber at a time. There are no overt toxins, no immediately harmful chemicals. Some readouts across the ship begin to record a slight change in the composition of the air, but by then the insidious weapon is already wreaking havoc. The giant warriors Portia has just defeated have been injected with a concentrated form of the drug. Portia now examines them curiously. She sees their strange, weirdly mobile eyes twitch and jerk, dragged up and about and around by the sight of invisible terrors, as the substance attacks their brains. Everything is going according to plan. She wants to stay and bind them, but they do not have the time, and she does not know if mere silk could restrain such gigantic monsters. She must hope that the initial incapacity, seen in the mammal test subjects as well, has the intended permanent consequences. It would be inconvenient if the giants somehow recovered. Portia's people move on, swift and determined. The substance is harmless to their own physiology, passing over their book lungs without effect. Shortly after, they come to a room filled with giants. These are not armed, and they are in several sizes which Portia surmises to be adult and juveniles of various moultings. They are already succumbing to the invisible gas, staggering drunkenly about, collapsing on suddenly fluid legs or just lying there, staring at sights that exist only in their own minds. There is a strong organic scent in the air, though Portia does realise that many of her victims have soiled themselves. They check that there is nobody left to fight them. Then they move on. There are plenty more giants to conquer. Chapter 7.9 Last Stand. They could hear Cast shouting and screaming for an appallingly long time, his microphone fixed on an open channel.
His suit camera gave them blurred glimpses of hull, stars, other struggling figures. Lane was shouting at him in a cracked voice, urging him to get inside the ship. But Cast was past hearing her, instead fighting furiously with something they could not see. From the fumbling of his gloves, glimpsed briefly in the periphery of the image, it looked as though he was trying to pry his own helmet off. Then abruptly, he cut off, and for a moment they thought he had simply ceased transmitting. But his channel remained open. And now they heard a gurgling sound, a wet choking. The wild movement of the camera had ceased, and the starfield drifted past Cast's view almost peacefully.
"Oh, no, no, no,"
Lane got out, before a segmented leg arched up from beyond the camera's view to plant itself on Cast's faceplate. They only saw a piece of the thing as it crouched on his shoulder, bunching itself for better purchase. A hairy arachnid with a shimmering exoskeleton, and a suggestion of curved fangs within some kind of mask. Man's oldest fear, waiting for him here at the outer reach of human expansion, already equipped for space. There were reports coming in from all across the ship by then. Teams of engineers were suiting up, lightweight work suits, without any of the armour or systems that had done Cast so little good, and heading into the hostile, contested territory of the cargo holds. Others were trying to repel boarders wherever the scuttling creatures had entered. The problem was that with the hull sensors torn up in so many places, the Gilgamesh could only make a poor guess at precisely where they had broken in. For bitter minutes, Lane tried to coordinate the various groups, some of them out there on command orders, others just vigilantes from the tribe, or woken cargo who had been awaiting a replacement suspension chamber. Then something changed around them. Holston and Lane exchanged glances, both knowing instantly that something was wrong, but neither able to quite say what. Something ubiquitous, never consciously noted, and always taken for granted, had gone away. And at the last, Lane said, "Life support." Holston felt his chest freeze at the very thought.
"What?"
"I think..." She looked at her screens. "Air circulation has ceased. The vents have shut off. Which means..." "Which means don't do any more breathing than you have to, because we're suddenly short on oxygen."
"What the fuck is..."
"Lane?" The old engineer screwed her face up.
"Vetus, what's going on?"
"I've shut the air off, Lane." There was a curious tone to the scientist's voice, somewhere between determined and frightened. Lane's eyes were fixed on Holston, trying to take strength from him.
"Would you care to explain why?"
"The spiders have released some sort of chemical or biological weapon. I'm segmenting the ship, cutting off areas that haven't been infected yet."
"Cutting off areas that haven't been infected?"
"I'm afraid it's quite widespread," Vetus's voice confirmed almost briskly, like a doctor trying to cover bad news with a smile. "I think I can work around those areas and restore a limited air circulation that's uncontaminated. But for now..."
"How do you know all this?"
Lane demanded. "My assistants in the lab have all collapsed. They're suffering some sort of fit. They're completely oblivious." A tiny, swiftly quashed tremor lay behind the words. "I myself... I'm in a sealed test chamber. I was working on a biological weapon of my own to win the war, annihilate the species without having to fire a shot. How could we know they'd beat us to it?"
"I don't suppose that's near completion,"
Lane asked, without much hope.
"I'm close, I think. The Gilgamesh's records on old Earth zoology are rather incomplete. Lane, we're going to have to root uncontaminated air," the engineer finished.
She was hunched over a console, trembling hands stabbing at it in desperate, jagged flurries. She looked older, as though the last hour had loaded another decade onto her shoulders.
"I'm on it. Holston, you need to warn our people. Get them to put on masks, or fall back to wherever I'll tell you in..."
Holston was already doing his best, fighting the Gilgamesh's intermittently unreliable interface, calling up each group he could locate on the system. Some did not answer. The spider's weapon was spreading invisibly from compartment to compartment, even as Vetus and Lane fought to seal it off. He raised Alpash with a surge of relief,
They're using gas or something.
I know, the tribe engineer confirmed.
We're masked. Won't work for long, though. This is emergency kit.
His voice sounded weirdly exhilarated, despite it all.
Lane's preparing a...
The proper words fell into place just in time.
Fallback position. Have you seen any...
We just shot the fuck out of one bunch of them,
Alpash confirmed fiercely.
It occurred to Holston that the fight was different for the tribe.
Yes, intellectually he knew that the Gill was the only haven for all mankind, and that his species' survival depended on it right now, but it was still just a ship to him, a means of crossing from one place to another. To Alpash and his people, it was home.
Right, well, you should fall back to...
And by that time, Lane had prepared a route, working with furious concentration while her breath wheezed in and out between her lips.
Vetus!
The old engineer barked.
Still here?
The bodiless voice sounding no more distant than the scientist's usual tones.
All this compartmentalization is going to hamper your own weapons dispersal, I take it.
Vetus made a curious noise. Perhaps it was meant as a laugh, but there was a knife edge of hysteria to sabotage it.
I'm... behind enemy lines. I'm cut off, Lane. If I can brew something up, I can get it to the... to them. And I'm close. I'll poison the lot of them.
Holston made contact with another band of fighters, heard a brief, cacophonic slice of shouting and screaming, and then lost them.
I think you'd better hurry, he said hoarsely.
Fuck! Lane spat.
I've lost... We're losing safe areas.
She bunched her crabbed hands.
What's... They're moving through the ship, came Vetus's ghostly voice. They're cutting through the doors, the walls, the ducts.
The shakiness was growing in her tone.
Machines. They're just machines. Machines of a dead technology. That's all they can be. Biological weapons. Who the fuck would make giant spiders as biological weapons?
Lane growled, still recalibrating her sealed areas, sending fresh instructions for Holston to relay to the rest of the crew.
Lane.
There was something in the scientist's voice that made the two of them stop.
What is it?
Lane demanded. There was a long gap into which Lane spoke Vetus's name several times without response. And then...
They're here. In the lab. They're here.
You're safe?
Sealed off?
Lane,
they're here.
And it was as though all the human emotion that Vetus so seldom gave rein to had been saved up for this moment, just to cram into her quivering voice and scream out of every word.
They're here. They're here. They're looking at me. Lane, please. Send someone. Send help. Someone, please. They're coming towards me. There.
And then a shriek, so loud that it cut the transmission into static for a second.
They're on the glass! They're on the glass! They're coming through! They're eating through the glass! Lane! Lane! Help me! Please, Lane! I'm sorry! I'm sorry!
Holston never got to know what Vetus was sorry for, and there were no more words. Even over the woman's screaming, they actually heard the almighty crack as the spiders broke into her test chamber. Then Vetus's voice abruptly died away, just a shuddering exhalation left out of all that terrified noise. Lane and Holston exchanged glances, neither of them finding much to be hopeful about.
Alpash, the classicist tried. Alpash, report?
No more words from Alpash. Either the ambusher had become the ambushed, or perhaps the radio wasn't functioning anymore. Like everything else, like their defence of the ship itself, it was falling apart. The lights were going out all over the Gilgamesh, one by one. The safe zones that Lane set up were compromised just as quickly, or were not as safe as the computers told her. Each band of defenders encountered its final battle, the spiders within the ship becoming only more numerous, more confident. And in the hold, the tens of thousands who were the balance of the human race slept on, never knowing that the battle for their future was being lost. There were no nightmares in suspension. Holston wondered if he should envy them. He didn't, though. Rather face the final moment with open eyes.
It's not looking good. It was a rather laboured piece of understatement, an attempt to lighten Lane's mind just for a moment. Her creased, time-worn face turned to him, and she reached out and clasped his hand with her own. We've come so far. No indication as to whether she meant the ship, or just the two of them. They each spent a few moments in assessment of the spreading damage, and when they next spoke, it was almost together. I can't raise anyone, from Holston. I've lost integrity in the next chamber, from Lane. Just us left. All the computers are on the blink again. We lasted too long, in the end. Holston, the classicist, felt that he was a man uniquely qualified to look down the road that time had set them all on. What a history! From monkey to mankind, through tool use, family, community, mastery of the environment around them, competition, war, the ongoing extinction of so many of the species who had shared the planet with them. There had been that fragile pinnacle of the old empire then, when they had been like gods and walked between the stars and created abominations on planets far from Earth, and killed each other in ways undreamt of by their monkey ancestors. And then us, the inheritors of a damaged world, reaching for the stars even as the ground died beneath their feet, the human race's desperate gamble with the Ark ships. Ark ship. Singular now, as we've not heard from the rest. And still they had squabbled and fought, given way to private ambition, to feuding, to civil war. And all that while, our enemy, our unknown enemy, has grown stronger. Lane had stalked over to the hatch, her stick clacking on the floor. It's warm, she said softly. They're outside. They're cutting. Masks. Holston had located some and held one out to her. Remember? I don't think we'll need a private channel any more. He had to help her with the straps, and eventually she just sat down, hands trembling before her, looking small and frail and old. I'm sorry, she said at last. I led us all to this. Her hand was in his, cold and almost fleshless, like soft, worn leather over bone. You couldn't have known. You did what you could. Nobody could have done any better. Just comforting platitudes, really. Any weapons in here? It's amazing what you don't plan for, isn't it? Something of Lane's dry humour returning. Use my stick. Squash a spider for me. For a moment, Holston thought she was joking, but she proffered him the metal rod, and at last he accepted it, hefting its surprising weight. Was this the scepter that had kept the nascent society of the tribe in line from generation to generation? How many challenges for leadership had Lane beaten down with it through the ages? It was practically a holy relic. It was a club. In that sense, it was a quintessentially human thing, a tool to crush, to break, to lever apart in the prototypical way that humanity met the universe head-on. And how do they meet the world? What does the spider have as its basic tool? Briefly, he entertained the thought, they build. And it was a curiously peaceful image. But then his console sounded, and he almost fell over the stick in lunging for it. A transmission? Someone was alive out there. For a moment, he found himself trying to drag his hand back, thinking that it would be some message from them, some garbled mess of almost Imperial Sea, within which that inhuman intelligence, malign and undeniable, would be hiding. Lane? Came a soft and wavering voice. Lane? Are you... Lane? Holston stared. There was something dreadful about the words. Something shuddering, damaged, unformed. Cast. Lane identified it. Her eyes were wide. Lane? I'm coming back, Cast continued, sounding calmer than he had ever been. I'm coming back in now. Cast? It's all right, came the voice of the security chief. It's all right. It's going to be all right. Cast, what happened to you? Holston demanded.
It's fine. I understand now. But the spiders?
They're... And a long pause, as though Cast was fumbling through the contents of his own brain for the right words.
Like us.
They're us.
They're...
like us.
Cast!
And we're coming back in now.
All of us.
And Holston had the terrifying, irrational thought of a sucked dry, withered husk within an armoured suit, but still, impossibly, animate.
Holston.
Lane clutched at his arm. There was a kind of haze in the air now, a faint chemical fog. Not the killer weapon of the spiders, but whatever was eating away the hatch. Then there was a hole near its lower edge, and something was coming through. For a moment, they regarded one another. Two scions of ancient tree-dwelling ancestors, with large eyes and inquisitive minds. Holston hefted Lane's stick. The spider was huge, but only huge for a spider. He could smash it. He could sunder that hairy shell and scatter pieces of its crooked legs. He could be human in that last moment. He could exult in his ability to destroy. But there were more of them crawling through the breach, and he was old, and Lane was older now, and he sought that other human quality so scarce of late, and put his arms around her, holding the woman as tightly to him as he dared, the stick clattering to the floor.
"Lane!" came Cast's ghostly voice. "Mason!" And then, "Come on, pick up the pace!"
to his own people.
"Cut yourself free if you're stuck."
And the spark of impatience there was Cast's, through and through, despite his newfound tranquility. The spiders spread out a little, those huge saucer eyes fixed on the two of them from behind the clear masks the creatures were wearing. Meeting that alien gaze was a shock of contact Holston had only known before in confronting his own kind. He saw one of the creature's rear legs bunch and tense. The spiders leapt, and then it was over. Chapter 7.10 The Quality of Mercy. The shuttle seems to take forever to fall from the clear blue sky. There is quite a crowd gathered here, on a cleared field beyond the edge of the Great Nest district of Seven Trees City. On the ground, and in the surrounding trees and silk structures, thousands of spiders are clustered close and waiting. Some are frightened. Some are exhilarated. Some are less than well informed regarding what precisely is about to happen. There are several dozen seeing eye colonies too, and these capture and send images to chromatopore screens across the world, to be viewed by millions of spiders, to be pored over by stomatopods beneath the waves, to be gazed at with varying degrees of incomprehension, by a number of other species who stand close to the brink of sentience. Even the spitters, the neocytodes on their wilderness reservations, may see images of this moment. History is being made. Moreover, history is beginning. A new era. Dr. Avrana Kern watches, omnipresent, as her children prepare themselves. She's still not convinced, but so many millennia of cynicism will take time to wash away. "We should have destroyed them," is her persistent thought. But then, and despite the dispersed form she currently inhabits, she's only human. Her surviving files on human neurochemistry, together with the spider's own investigations of their long-ago captive, have wrought this. She has not been its prime mover, though. The spiders themselves argued long and hard over how to respond to the long-awaited invaders, discounting her advice more than following it. They were aware of the stakes. They accepted her assessment of the path the humans would follow if given free rein over the planet. Genocide, of other species and of their own, was ever a tool in the human kit. The spiders have been responsible for a few extinctions along the way too, but their early history with the ants has led them down a different road. They have seen the way of destruction, but
but they have seen the way the ants made use of the world, too. Everything can be a tool. Everything is useful. They never did wipe out the spitters, just as they never exterminated the ants themselves, a decision that later would become the basis of their burgeoning technology. Faced with the arrival of humanity, the creator species, the giants of legend, the spider's thought was not, how can we destroy them, but how can we trap them? How can we use them? What is the barrier between us that makes them want to destroy us? The spiders have equivalents of the prisoner's dilemma, but they think in terms of intricate interconnectivity, of a world not just of sight, but of constant vibration and scent. The idea of two prisoners incapable of communication would not be an acceptable status quo for them, but a problem to overcome. The prisoner's dilemma as a Gordian knot to be cut through, rather than be bound by. They have long known that within their own bodies and in other species across the planet, there is a message. In ancient times, when they fought the plague, they recognized this as something distinct from their own genetic code, and took it to be the work of the messenger. In a manner of speaking, they were correct. Long ago, they isolated the nanovirus in their own systems. It had not escaped their notice that creatures formed like the giants, mice and similar vertebrates seeded across their world, did not carry the nanovirus, and so lacked a commonality that seemed to bind the spiders to each other, and to other arthropod species. Mice were just animals. There seemed no possibility of them ever becoming anything else. Compared to them, the porcid beetles, or a dozen other similar creatures, were practically bursting with potential. The spiders have worked long and hard to craft and breed a variant of the nanovirus that attacks mammalian neurology. Not the full virus in all its complexity, but a simple, single-purpose tool that is virulent, transmissible, inheritable, and irreversible. Those parts of the nanovirus that would bolster evolution have been stripped out, too complex and too little understood, leaving only one of the virus's base functions intact. It is a pandemic of the mind, tweaked and mutated to rewrite certain very specific parts of the mammal brain. The very first effect of the nanovirus, when it touched the ancient Portia labiata spiders so many thousands of generations ago, was to turn a species of solitary hunters into a society. Like calls out to like, and those touched by the virus knew their comrades, even when they did not have enough cognitive capacity to know themselves. Kern, and all the rest, watches the shuttle land. Up on the Gilgamesh, orbiting 100 kilometers beyond the equatorial web and its space elevators, there are many humans, all infected, and thousands still sleeping, who will need to have the virus introduced to them. That task will take a long time, but then this landing is the first step towards integration, and that will also take a long time. Even within the spiders, the nanovirus has fought a long battle against ingrained habits of cannibalism and spouse slaying. Its notable success has been mostly within species, though. Porteids have always been hunters, and so pan-specific empathy would have crippled them. This was the true test of their biochemical ingenuity. The spiders have done their best, conducting what tests they can on lesser mammals. But only after Portia and her peers had taken control of the Ark ship and its crew could the truth be known. The task was not just to take a cut-down version of the virus and reconfigure it so as to attack a mammal brain, difficult enough on its own, but essentially useless. The real difficulty for that legion of spider scientists, working over generations and each inheriting the undiluted learning of the last, was to engineer the human infection to know its parents, to recognize the presence of itself in its arachnid creators, and call out to that similarity. Kinship at the submicrobial level, so that one of the Gilgamesh's great giants, the awesome, careless creator gods of prehistory, might look upon Portia and her kin and know them as their children. Once the shuttle has landed, the spiders press closer, a seething, hairy, greyish tide of legs and fangs and staring, lidless eyes. Kern watches the hatch open, and the first humans appear. There is a handful of them only. This is, in itself, an experiment simply to see if the nanovirus fragment has produced the desired effect. They step down among the tide of spiders, whose hard, bristly bodies bump against them. There is no evident revulsion, no sudden panic. The humans, to Kern's reconfigured eyes, seem entirely at ease. One even puts her hand out, letting it brush across the thronging backs. The virus in them is telling them all, "This is us. They are like us." It tells the spiders the same. That crippled fragment of virus calling out to its more complete cousins, "We are like you." And Kern guesses, then, that the spiders' meddling might go further than they had thought. If there had been some tiny bead present in the brain of all humans that had told each other, "They are like you," that had drawn some thin silk thread of empathy, person to person, in a planet-wide net, what might then have happened? Would there have been the same wars, massacres, persecutions and crusades? Probably, thinks Kern sourly. She wants to discuss it with Fabian, but even her faithful acolyte has crept out into the sunlight to watch this firsthand. At the shuttle's hatch, Portia steps out after the humans, along with some of her peer group. The enormity of what she has played a part in is mostly lost on her. She is glad to be alive. Many of her fellows are not so lucky. The cost of bringing the human race around to their point of view has been high. But worth it, Bianca had assured her when she aired that thought. After this day, who knows what we may accomplish together? They are responsible for our being here, after all. We are their children, though until now they did not know us. Amongst the humans is one who Portia had thought was injured or ill, but now understands to be simply at the end of her long giant's life. Another, a male, has carried her from the shuttle and laid her on the ground, with the spiders forming a curious, jostling but respectful circle around them. Portia sees the ailing human's hands clench at the ground, gripping the grass. She stares up at the blue sky with those strange, narrow eyes, but eyes in which Portia can find a commonality, now that the bond of the nanovirus runs both ways. She is dying, the old human. The oldest human there ever was, if Kern has translated that correctly. That she is dying on a world that will become her people's world, that her people will share with its other people. Portia cannot be sure, but she thinks this old human is content with that. Part 8. Diaspora. Chapter 8.1. To Boldly Go. Helena Holston Lane reclines in her webbing, feeling at ease in the zero gravity, whilst around her the rest of the crew complete their pre-launch checks. The ship has two names, and they both mean the same thing, Voyager. Helena does not know that this was once, in a long-ago age, the name for a pioneering human space vehicle, one that might, millennia after its launch, still be speeding through the cosmos somewhere, a silent record of achievement, long forgotten by its maker's descendants. There is nothing of the long-dismantled Gilgamesh in the Voyager, save the ideas. The old technology of Earth, so painstakingly husbanded by Helena's great-great-grandmother, has been resurrected, rediscovered, built upon, and advanced. The scientists amongst the spiders first learned what the humans could teach about their technology of metal and electricity, computers and fusion drives. After that, they taught it back to their tutors' children, broadened and enhanced by a non-human perspective. In the same way,
Human minds have unravelled the threads of the spider's own complex biotechnology and offered their insights. Both species have limits they cannot easily cross. Mental, physical, sensory. That is why they need each other. The Voyager is a living thing with a fusion reactor heart. A vast piece of bioengineering with a programmable nervous system and a symbiotic ant colony that regulates, repairs, and improves it. It carries a crew of 70 and the stored genetic material of tens of thousands of others and hundreds of thousands of understandings. This is a vessel of exploration, not a desperate ark ship, but the journey will last many sleeping years and the precautions seemed wise. The two peoples of the green world work together in easy harmony now. There was a generation of wary caution on both sides. But once the nanovirus had taken down those barriers, between species and between individuals, so much potential tragedy was already averted. Life is not perfect. Individuals will always be flawed. But empathy, the sheer inability to see those around them as anything other than people too, conquers all in the end. Communication was always the great problem at the start, Helena knows. Spiders lack the ability to hear speech as anything more than a tickling of the feet, while humans lack the sensitive touch required to detect the wealth of arachnid language. Technology on both sides came to the rescue, of course, and there was always the sour, recalcitrant presence of Avrana Kern. The common language, everyone's second language, is that curious mangled Imperial Sea that Kern and the spiders worked out between them when she was still the messenger and they her faithful. The dead language lives on. Helena's great-great-grandfather would find that thought hilarious, no doubt. All of the living ship's systems are within tolerance, the organic readouts confirm. Helena adds her own confirmation to the chorus, waiting for the word. She is not the commander of this mission. That honour goes to Portia, the spider's first ever interstellar pioneer. Hunched in her own webbing slung from the ceiling, or at least the curved side of their chamber that faces Helena's, the spider considers the moment for a few seconds, exchanges quick radio communication with the dock and with the world below, and then speaks to the ship itself. When you wish. The ship's response, though positive, has a fragment of the dry wit of Dr. Avrana Kern. Its biomechanical intelligence is extrapolated from what she once was, a child of Kern budded off her, with her blessing. With awesome, colossal grace, the Voyager reconfigures its shape for optimum efficiency and detaches itself from the orbital web, a structure vastly grander than when the Gilgamesh first saw it, and now blooming with green solar collectors, dotted with other amorphous spacecraft that have already plotted the extent of the green planet's solar system. The Voyager is more fuel efficient than the Gilgamesh, or even than the old Empire's vessels, according to Kern. Sometimes all it takes to crack a problem is a new perspective. The vessel's reactor can accelerate smoothly and constantly for far longer, decelerate likewise, and the ship's fluid internal structure will protect the crew from extremes of acceleration far more effectively. The journey out will be a sleep of mere decades, not millennia or even centuries. Still, it is a grand step, and not to be taken lightly. Although returning to the stars was always a certainty that both species had worked hard towards, nobody would ever have suggested reaching out there quite yet, if it had not been for the signal. The message. Out of all the points of light in the sky, one of them is talking. It is not saying anything comprehensible, but the message is plainly something more than mere static. Something more structured than the orderly calls of pulsars or any other known phenomenon of the universe. The work, in short, of intelligence, where there should be none. How could the people of the green planet ignore such a beacon? The Voyager begins its long acceleration, gently stressing the bodies of its crew, realigning its internal geometry. Soon they will sleep, and when they wake,
there will be a new world awaiting them. An unknown world of perils and wonders and mystery. A world that calls out for them. Not an alien world, though. Not entirely. The ancient progenitors of the people of the Green Planet walked there once. It exists on the Gilgamesh's star maps, another island in the strung-out Terraformers archipelago that was left to its own devices by the collapse of the old empire. After all the years, the wars, the tragedies and the loss, the spiders and the monkeys are returning to the stars to seek their inheritance. You've been listening to Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky, read by Mel Hudson.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.